Good evening. My name is Jeffrey Sachs. I'm the director of Atid. On behalf of myself and Rabbi Chaim Bravender, the president of Atid, it is a great honor to welcome all of you here to this very full house, and to welcome, of course, Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter, dean of the Rabbi Soloveitchik Institute of Boston. It has long been our desire in our Atid Fellows program to expose the young teachers and educators that come to study with us to a figure of Rabbi Schachter's stature that they're not privileged to be exposed to on a regular basis because of the distance between Boston and Jerusalem, or between the United States and Eretz Yisrael. And during his week here, Rabbi Schachter is spending a very intensive time with us, teaching and mentoring, giving seminars to the fellows, meeting one-on-one with the young people and the working groups that take part in our program all year long. And it's been a very, very rich opportunity. But we, of course, also thought it was appropriate and correct that Atid should also share this great privilege with the wider community of those interested in Torah education. And therefore, we were able to organize tonight's event. Rabbi Schachter will speak on the topic of the role of general studies in Torah education, the lessons from the approach of Rabbi Soloveitchik. We're also blessed to have an opportunity to think together, to think a little bit out loud, collectively as a group of teachers, parents, people interested in the fate of Jewish education, and to have with us respondents, people who will try to draw out the implications of Rabbi Schachter's presentation to the realities of Torah education, the realities of Torah education in general, as well as the specific challenges that we're posed with here in Israel. And we have with us Dr. Beverly Gribitz, who's involved with us all year long at Atid, involved in designing and executing the program, but is, of course, the principal of the Evelina de Rothschild School here in Jerusalem. She was, of course, the headmistress of the Ramaz School in New York for a number of years prior to this stint in Jerusalem, and therefore she brings a wealth of experience from both sides of the ocean. And we're very, very pleased to have with us Rav Shimon Adler, the Rosh Minhal Chinuch HaDati, the head of religious education for the Misrad HaChinuch, the Ministry of Education here in Israel, who will also respond, particularly with an eye to the state of things here in our country. Then afterwards, there'll be time for some questions from the audience. I'd like to just begin with a brief quote that I think highlights the real challenge of thinking about, even before we get to actually planning out policy, thinking about the relationship between general studies and Torah education, and the very weighty challenge that anyone that aspires to even discuss this topic in the same sentence with the name Rabbi Soloveitchik, the very weighty challenge we're faced with. In his eulogy, in his tribute for Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rabbi Yitzchak Twersky, who, as you know, was his son-in-law, writes, "What is distinctive is the fact that the Rav does not preach or cajole, persuade or brainwash. He does not present an elaborate rationale for the study of philosophy. The latter simply appears as part of his intellectual capital. He uses it freely and wisely and effectively in his various expositions and explorations of Jewish thought. The Rav's philosophic and homiletical corpus has no apologetics. There is no attempt to argue and demonstrate the importance of general learning as an abstract proposition, just as there is no attempt to defend or glorify Western culture. Similarly, there is no attempt to demonstrate that traditional Judaism is completely congruent with philosophy or any part of it. This truly noteworthy feature is a result of the fact that, for the Rav, there was nothing essentially problematic about the Masorah. He did not feel compelled to prove that Torah and philosophy, or Torah and science, are compatible. That being said, and as I'm sure we're about to hear, there's a lot said on exactly what Rabbi Soloveitchik's position on this question was. We are indeed faced with a great challenge, one which I'm sure we'll receive enlightenment on this evening. Rabbi Schechter.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Sachs, for the introduction. Potchin b'chvod achsanya, I would like to begin by thanking Rabbi Bravender and Rabbi Sachs for inviting me to come to spend a week with the fellows of Atid and to have the opportunity to spend some time with all of you as well. The more time I've been spending with Atid, the more impressed I am with the substance and the depth and the sophistication of the program. And it is a remarkable achievement, and I hope and pray that the wonderful work that are being done under the auspices of Atid will continue and will continue to have such a great impact on Israeli society. It is also a great honor for me to appear together with Dr. Beverly Gribitz and Rabbi Shimon Adler, noted and excellent educators in the state of Israel. For me, it is a kavod gadol. I'm also overwhelmed by the number of people that I know in the audience. I almost go row by row, person by person, and thank you for coming and tell you how happy I am to see you, and maybe we'll have occasion a few minutes at the end of the lecture just to say hello to one another. Both family members and friends and wonderful young friends from Brookline who do me great honor by their presence who are studying here this year in Israel. Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal was born on Yud Bet Adar, February 27, 1903. And the Rav was born into one of the most learned and renowned rabbinic families in the Jewish Europe of his time. He was born into the rabbinic aristocracy of Lithuanian Jewry. The Elta Zayda, the Beis Halevi, the Zayda Reb Chaim, leaders, giants of Torah scholarship in Lithuanian Jewry. The Rav was very influenced by his paternal Zayda, by Reb Chaim, by his maternal Zayda, Rebella Prusiner, Rebella Feinstein. He was very much influenced by his uncle, the Griz, Reb Velvel. He was very much influenced by the Chabad Malamed that he had in Chaslavich, who opened up a whole world of spirituality to him. The Rav very often spoke about the tremendous impact of this particular Malamed on his own religious development. The Rav was also very influenced by his mother, a little bit more open. The Rav's sister, in her book about the family, writes about the tension between the Soloveitchik family and the Feinstein family in terms of openness or closeness to secular culture and to the world around us. We'll come back to that. And it was his mother who exposed the Rav first to secular literature. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, in a brief biography that he wrote of the Rav of his father-in-law about 40 years ago, writes, and I quote, "He acquired lifelong taste in literature from his mother, who led him from fairy tales to Ibsen, Pushkin, Lermontov, and Bialik." 1920, the Rav and his family moved to Warsaw. Until that time, the Rav is living virtually a life of Kulo Torah. His father had the greatest, the most significant impact on him. His father was his Rebbe Muvhak. His father learned with him Yomam Valayla for years. The Rav never attended a formal yeshiva, but learned at the feet of his father for a very long time, many, many mesachtes. In 1920, they're forced, because of the whole communist upheaval, to move to Warsaw, and here the Rav gets his first formal exposure to secular studies. If you take a look on page one, I hope all of you have a copy of the sheets. We'll be working off of the sheets tonight, or you're sitting next to somebody who has a copy. There's a remarkable file of the Rav's in the University of Berlin. And in this file, there are a number of important papers that I have Xeroxed for you to bring to your attention this evening. The Rav writes a little bit of a biography about himself, about the end of the time when he was ready to leave the University of Berlin, and we'll spend a lot of time on that. You have it on the top left-hand side of page one with the Rav's signature, and you have an English translation at the bottom. 1922, I graduated the liberal arts gymnasium in Dubnov, and thereafter I entered in 1924 the Free Polish University in Warsaw, where I spent 3 terms studying political science. So the Rav already has some kind of exposure to secular studies, informal through his mother, and more formal in Dubnov, and then much more so as part of the Free Polish University in Warsaw. And in 1926, the Rav moves to the University of Berlin. He moves from a Torah-centered traditional culture of Brisk, of his childhood, of the Mesorah, of his Mishpacha, of his family, and he moves to the secular and Goyishe metropolis of Berlin. He leaves the familiar environment of his family, revolving almost exclusively on intense involvement in Talmud Torah, and he moves to a society that's governed by very different values. The Rav once said, and I quote, that I remembered when I first arrived in Germany, I was shocked by the joyful tunes that were sung as part of the liturgy on Yom Kippur. They were in stark contrast to the apprehensiveness and fear that permeated the synagogues in Eastern Europe on this day. So the Rav growing up was used to the Ema, the Yira, the Reses, the Zeya, after all it's a Yom HaDin, nervousness and tension. And here he writes, he comes to Germany and he was shocked by the joyful tunes. It's a Yom Tiv. It's not only a Yom HaDin, it's a Yom Tiv. It has certain halachas of Yom Tiv. It's reflected in the singing. And he's shocked by the transfer from what it was that he was accustomed to what he found in Germany. But it's clear that the culture shock for this rather sheltered young 23-year-old far transcended the different tunes that were sung in shul. The Rav once told one of his Talmidim, and I quote, "You have no idea how enormously difficult it was for me to move from the world of Reb Chaim to that of Berlin University. Even my children cannot appreciate it, because they already found a paved road." We can only imagine how difficult it must have been for him on those long winter nights in a foreign country with an even more foreign and alien culture. How did the Rav get to the University of Berlin? What I want to do for the first part of my lecture is to focus on the biography of the Rav, talk a little bit about Berlin, talk a little bit about other aspects of his life, with a specific focus on the nature of the interrelationship with him and general studies. And then in the last part of the talk, I want to speak more theoretically or conceptually to try to tease out from the writings of the Rav certain points that reflect his understanding of the relationship between Judaism and general culture, and leave a lot of the application to my 2 distinguished panelists who will address it more in a tachlis orientation. How much of a real betrayal was it of the family heritage of the Rav to go to the University of Berlin? And what interests me, and I want to come back to it also again in the theoretical part of the talk, is that the Rav publicly reflected on his break with his family when it came to religious Zionism. This was a subject of a lecture that he already gave last evening, the nature of the relationship between the Rav and religious Zionism, the attitude of the Rav to religious Zionism. And the Rav publicly spoke at a Mizrahi convention and reflected on what it meant for him to leave the Mesorah of his family and the break with his family over the position on religious Zionism. The Elta Zeda de Beis Halevi and the Zeda Reb Chaim were not Zionists, to put it mildly. The Fetter of Velvel, to put it very mildly, was not a Zionist. And the Rav understood that he stood in a different place. But yet, nowhere does the Rav reflect on what I believe is a much more fundamental break, or potentially a much more fundamental break, and that is over the issue of secular studies. It's clear that secular studies were important for the Rav, and that he and his parents took them seriously. If you look on the right-hand side of page one, there's a quote from the book I referred to earlier, from the Rav sister, Shalamis Meiselman, the Soloveitchik Heritage. And she alludes here, this is already towards the end of the book, of what I had myself alluded to just a moment ago about the tension between the mother's family and the father's family. Influenced by my mother's deep conviction that there is no room for ignorance in an observant Jew, father adopted an entirely different approach to secular education. Now, up until that point, Rav Moshe, the father of the Rav, the father of Mrs. Meiselman, the son of Rav Chaim, the brother of Rav Velvel, felt the way the family felt, that there really wasn't such a room, significant room for secular education. But the mother, the wife, influenced him to change his mind. She came from a family that was more open. He now maintained a new philosophy, that in this changing world, both religious and general education were necessary if one was to have an effective influence on Jewish young people. A pious Jew must be part of the world at large and must participate in all the endeavors of his community, provided, of course, that they are not at variance with the tradition and do not threaten his uniqueness as an Orthodox Jew. Secular education thus became part of our life. The best private tutors were engaged to prepare my two older brothers for the university. They responded enthusiastically to their new course of studies, and within a few years were ready for their entrance examinations. To fulfill their lifetime dream about Joseph Dove's future in Jewish life, my parents decided to leave the decision regarding his university education to him. His choice was the University of Berlin, famous for its philosophy department, which became his field of interest. Rav Aaron wrote in the article that I referred to earlier on page two on the left-hand side, University of Berlin, it's exactly 40 years ago this year. When he was 22, Rav Soloveitchik entered the University of Berlin and for the first time approached the serious study of a secular discipline. His chosen field was philosophy. At the university, he plunged into the more abstract and abstruse aspects of philosophy, focusing his interest on the study of logic, metaphysics, and epistemology. In all these areas, particularly the last two, the current approach was influenced by the thought and philosophy of Kant, and Soloveitchik steeped himself in Kantianism and its dicta. The Rav studied at the University of Berlin with a number of prominent professors. You have the list at the bottom of page one on the left-hand side and that little brief autobiographical note, the list of the professors he studied with. Rav Aaron tells us in this article that the first choice of the Rav's dissertation topic was Maimonides and Plato, because the Rav was of the opinion that it was by no means clear that the Rambam was as confirmed an Aristotelian as the standard scholarly understanding of the Rambam was, that there was more Plato in the Rambam that hitherto appreciated. But the problem was that there was nobody at the university who was qualified to supervise a dissertation on that subject. And so the Rav had to abandon his plan, and he wrote instead on the epistemology and metaphysics of Hermann Cohen, a leading neo-Kantian from the University of Marburg. On May 9, 1930, the Rav informed the university authorities that his dissertation was complete, and he asked for permission to undergo the oral examination. Permission was granted, and it was scheduled for July 24, 1930, and the Rav passed his orals. If you look on the right-hand side of page two, in the folder of the Ravs in the University of Berlin, there's a piece of paper which indicates how the Rav did on his oral examination. It's signed by the professors who were there who orally examined him. The first professor gave him a gut, and the second professor gave him a sehr gut. Either way, the Rav was good enough to be able to pass the orals in 1930. In the fall of 1930, the Rav moved to Vilna to get married. He married his wife, who for him was the most important person in his entire life. Their relationship is an unbelievable one and an incredible story. They were married in Vilna in 1931. In the fall of 31, they were back in Berlin. And they stayed there for 8 months. Until the early summer, when they began to move towards the United States. If you look at the bottom of page two, you have the title page of the Rav's doctoral dissertation. You'll see that the oral exam is the 24th of July, 1930, and the date that he was given his doctoral diploma was on the 10th of December, 1932. If you look on the left-hand side of page 3, you'll find a copy of the Rav's doctoral diploma. The Rav's father was very proud of the fact that his son mastered secular studies and that his son was an unbelievable Talmud Chacham. In 1935, the Rav, as I mentioned, came to the United States in 1932. He landed at the end of August. On December 11th, 1932, the Rav arrived in Boston. And in 1935, the position of the chief rabbinate of the Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Tel Aviv became open, and the Rav applied, and his father wrote for him a tremendous letter of recommendation, which was recently published. What's striking about this letter, and the only thing I want to draw your attention to in this context, is how Rav Moshe highlights both. The Rav is a Talmud Chacham, and not just a Talmud Chacham, but an unbelievable Talmud Chacham. And the Rav also is a Baki, is an unbelievable, wide-ranging knowledge of Chachma, of secular studies as well. In the third paragraph, the fourth paragraph, he invokes the Tata Rav Chaim, and how Rav Chaim saw Chedusha Torah of his Einikel and was so totally overwhelmed by them. So by invoking Rav Chaim was the Rav Chaim was the greatest, and Rav Chaim said that the Rav was Toroso Emes, so that clearly speaks to the substance of his Torah knowledge. And then in that same paragraph, he talks about Hitpatchuto b'Torah v'Chochma. The next paragraph, B'dorot ha-kodmim dimu she'i afshar b'mitziyut liyot Torah v'sharei Chochmot mishulavim yachad. Skip a sentence. V'im b'sharei Chochmot ba'ofan gadol hino ha-yachid u'miyuchad, ein tzafei ki hu ka'et yachid ador b'havanat ha-Torah. Gives you just an insight a little bit into Rav Moshe and the extent to which Rav Moshe was ready to write. It's about how a father writes about a son. It's just bichlal, a fascinating document. But leaving that aside, it's the substance of the document that I think is of great significance to us. And then he goes back to the Rav's Torah knowledge. Od rabot b'shanim mikvar kvar katav, katav alav agon av bezn dekovna, she'alacha kmoto b'chol makom. And in close, please find it. And if you turn to page 4 on the side, if you hold the page to the side, I Xerox for you the letter of recommendation from Avram Dov Be'er HaKohen Shapiro, the Av Bezin of Kovna, wrote for the Rav in the late summer of 1931. If you read this letter of recommendation, it is kulo Torah. It is kulo traditional. The Rav is an Einikel of Reb Chaim. The Rav follows in the footsteps of Reb Chaim. The Rav is swimming in the Yama Talmud. The Rav is a Baki Bishas. And ad kidei kach, v'halocha kamoso b'chol makom. And it's fully framed in a traditional context. And the Rav, even though he's been sitting 5 years by now in the University of Berlin, there's no reference to that whatsoever. There's no acknowledgement of that whatsoever. It's as if he's been sitting in yeshiva all of this time and accomplishing unbelievable heights in the study of Torah. And that is the sole emphasis and focus of the Kovna Rav's letter. And I mentioned that Dafka to contrast that with his father's letter. Because his father's letter isn't the sort of traditional standard yeshivish letter of recommendation, but he clearly acknowledges, and more than acknowledges, is extremely, extremely proud of the fact that his son is an unbelievable scholar in the field of German philosophy as well. And he keeps on going back and forth, and just in the middle of the last paragraph, he sigue Torah Doctor Philosophia ba'ofan achi mitzuyan, back to the page 3, ba'universitat de Berlin, and the professors there, hayu b'itpa'alut migodel kishronotav v'rochev ha'havanato ha'amuka, havanato ha'amuka shelo ra'u kazot. Mechadesh kam b'chochma zu ki ga'on hador. He's not only a gaon in learning, he's a gaon in German philosophy. Kar kvar itpis ma'at b'safa ashkenazit, so we have here somebody who is deeply engaged in Torah study. From his the Iker Yanika, his development, his growing up, was virtually kulo Torah, and then slowly he shifts out and achieves, in the understanding of his father, incredible prominence in both of these areas. The Rav was very much committed to his secular studies. He immersed himself in the study of philosophy, science, and literature, and he achieved mastery in those fields. In the same hesped that Rabbi Sacks read from earlier, that was written by my late teacher, Professor Tversky, about his father-in-law, Professor Tversky wrote as follows. He often reminisced with me, this is not Xerox, about his student years and his unquenchable thirst for knowledge, which he said was characteristic of many of his contemporaries. He recalled the straitened material circumstances that never dampened his enthusiasm for study. The impact of those years on him was great and lasting. His quest for wide-ranging scientific humanistic knowledge was successful. The record of his dedicated quest for an ongoing use of this knowledge is clear and unambiguous. And Dr. Tversky, in that article, in the hesped he gave for his father-in-law, shows how references to secular literature consistently appear throughout the Rav's writings. Even in his hesped for Reb Velvel, even in his hesped for the Griz, where he categorizes Reb Chaim's method of study, which was masterfully translated by Rabbi Sacks, he does so in the context of references to Galileo, to Newton, and to Kant. Secular literature was known to the Rav. He drew heavily upon it, easily and unselfconsciously, for his entire life. But we shouldn't for a second lose sight of the fact, notwithstanding all of this, the significant emphasis on secular studies, notwithstanding, there's no question that the study of Torah, v'higisa bo yomam v'layla, remained most central to the Rav's life. And there is no doubt that he was fully engaged in the study of Torah at the highest levels during those long and lonely winter nights in Berlin. The Rav's son, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, recently published a sefer that includes many chedushei Torah of his father, of the Rav, on many difficult sugyas in Shas, that the Rav sent, letters that the Rav sent to his father and to his old chavrusa during those years. Some of them were published, some of them were published in Reb Chaim's sefer for the first time. He had occasion, because he came from the family that he came with, to interact with the leading Gedolei Yisrael of his time. In addition to the Zaydis, he knew and had a relationship with Reb Chaim Moshe Grushinsky, Reb Shimon Shkop, Reb Baruch Ber of Kamenitz, Reb Yerucham of the Mir, Reb Lezer Yudel of the Mir. He lived in that world, and that world was extremely important to him. I want to show you two more sources, hitherto unknown, that reflect from the 1930s, after he finished the University of Berlin, the Rav's involvement in this case, philosophy. The bottom of page 4, you have a copy of a final examination that he gave to students at Yeshiva College in 1936. So you know that the Rav started to say, the highest cheer of Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, which later became an affiliate of what later became Yeshiva University, in 1941 when his father passed away. His father said the highest cheer, and then after a while, the Rav said the highest cheer. But the Rav had a relationship with Yeshiva College already in the 30s, and he used to travel from Boston to New York to teach philosophy in the college. And we have a copy here of an exam that the Rav gave, a philosophy exam. You take a look at it, you'll read it, you'll see we're talking about somebody who's holding in a high level in the study of philosophy. There's one that I just want to read to you because you'll see in a minute why it becomes significant. If you look, let's say, in the 2C, how does the consciousness of the ego reality change according to the method of approaching God? I invite you all now to take out a pen and paper. You're all intelligent people, right? You should know the answer to this question. First, you need to understand what the question is. Okay, I got it. Number 4A, the problem of Tamei HaMitzvos. Explain in connection with the subjectivity and objectivity in the religious consciousness. It's a simple matter. We can all do it. It's not a problem at all. Why do I specifically highlight Dafka that question? Because I found in the archives of the late Dr. Leo Young, and for many years I was the rabbi of the Jewish Center on the Upper West Side, the shul that was graced with incredible distinction by Rabbi Young for 65 years, I found in the archives of Rabbi Young a letter that the Rav sent to him in September of 1939. And you're seeing it now. This is an unknown letter. And it gives you a sense, after he finished with Berlin, that he's holding in the parsha of Jewish philosophy. December 5th, 1939. Sometimes when we read letters and we look at the date, we have all kinds of associations. And floods of associations come to our minds. Dear Rabbi Young, upon my return home from Chicago, I found in my mail your letter of August 14th. Accept my thanks for your invitation to write an essay on a Jewish philosophical subject to be published in the fifth volume of the Jewish Library. Rabbi Young published what he called the Jewish Library, and he came up with volume after volume after volume, and the goal was to raise the level of sophistication in terms of an understanding of Judaism. After consideration, I arrived at the decision to avail myself of this offer and contribute a chapter to your publication with the following reservations, however. And this is not only significant for our subject, but it gives us a sense of the personality of the Rav. Number one, I regret to say that I don't find the topic you suggested to my interest. It is very doubtful whether the Musar movement can at present be subjected to an exact philosophical analysis. I would rather choose as my subject the following problem. The neo-Kantian conception of the Subjectivity and Objectification Act and its application to the analysis of the Tamei HaMitzvos problem. Nishneh, nish veiniger, I'm not interested in the Musar movement, I can't really do it philosophically. I think philosophically, stam zu reden wegen Musar, that's not my thing. I want to tell you what I want to write about. And then he gives a little justification. The interpretation of this central thought of the neo-Kantian philosophy, this is 1939, and this is after that, that was a question on the exam that I just read to you a minute ago. So he wants to now give the answer to the question. It's a Chavekstellen, a whole analysis of this subject. The interpretation of this central thought of the neo-Kantian philosophy will prove to be of great value for the elucidation of the basical problem of modern Jewish philosophy. Few dissertations were written on Hermann Cohen's philosophy of religion based on his book, but as yet no attempt has been made to evaluate Cohen's theoretical philosophy as a source of modern Jewish thought. My intention is to exploit this latter field for the purpose of enriching our philosophical religious aspect. Number two is just as interesting as number one. I cannot accept any limitation for my essay as to the amount of words. Rabbi Young was a yekke. He wrote a letter. I want you to write 622 and a half words, and that's it. The Rav says, you can forget about it. This is not a magazine article which can be shortened or expanded according to wish. I will write as much as the full covering of the topic will require. It may be less, and it may be more than 8,000 words. But I'm not bound. I'm not bound. I'm holding Lamaila from the number of words. I'm going to write what I want to write. If these conditions are in line with your tentative plan for the publication, please inform me at your earliest convenience with greetings, etc. Sincerely yours, Joseph Soloveitchik. Needless to say, the Rav's article, Nebuch, on this subject never appeared in any volume of the Jewish Library that was edited by Rabbi Leo Young. The last biographical piece that I want to mention to you is weiter from the same article by Professor Tversky. And now we move from 1936 to 1939 and from 1939 to 1944. 1944, the Rav has a burst, literally a burst of literary activity. He publishes Isha Halacha. He writes Halachic Mind, which doesn't get published until many years later. And he writes Ubikashta Misham. The first version was supposed to be called Isha Elokim, sort of as a companion to Isha Halacha. Gets published again many years later as Ubikashta Misham. The middle 40s spurt of intellectual creativity. Dr. Tversky in his Hesped talks about in the context of talking about the centrality of philosophy for the Rav, as mentioned by Rabbi Sachs in his introduction, gives you sort of kilacher yad, just one example, and it's a very telling example, because he talks about the Rav's use of philosophy not in, let's say, Lonely Man of Faith, which is more of a philosophical work, but dafka in Isha Halacha, which is a very philosophical work. It's dafka in Isha Halacha where the Rav is trying to describe the personality of a halachic person. What does it mean to be a halachic person, an ish halacha? It's dafka there that the Rav draws upon an unbelievable amount of philosophical material. Writes Professor Tversky, right side, page 5. If all you read and knew nothing about the Rav, but all you read was ish halacha, you would confront a massive strategic reliance on the history of philosophy and science. Dafka, again, I'm trying to underscore, it's dafka and ish halacha. So it's particularly striking that when describing a halachic personality, the Rav describes the halachic personality in philosophical categories. The first two pages introduce you to Hegel, Kierkegaard, Rudolf Otto, Carbarth, Edward Spranger, Ferdinand Lassalle, Rousseau, Nietzsche, Bergson, Spengler, and Heidegger. A breathtaking list. In case you didn't get it, he just reminds you that it's a breathtaking list. A page later, Plato, Aristotle, Galileo, Newton, and soon thereafter, Husserl, Scheller, Berkeley, Hermann Cohen. If you persisted, writes Professor Tversky, and made your way to the end of this remarkable philosophical spiritual meditation, the very last note reminds you, refocuses your attention, Kant, Hermann Cohen, Kierkegaard, Ibsen, Scheler, Heidegger, together with the Rambam, Ibn Gabir, and once again after a passing reference to Donis Skodas, Weiter, Schopenhauer, and Nietzsche. These references reflect not only great erudition and precision in the history of philosophy, but also a philosophic temper, a philosophic mode of thinking, a subtle and analytic mind. The Rav incorporated philosophy comfortably and unselfconsciously into his work. So the first basic insight is that the Rav took his secular studies very seriously. And it will remain for my distinguished colleagues to bring that into the classroom. The Rav is a model of somebody who took secular studies seriously, and the Rav is a model of somebody, the model par excellence of somebody who took his Talmud Torah very seriously. Now I want to spend the last few minutes on the theoretical part of this discussion. And there is a tremendous irony here, one that has already been noted in the literature on the Rav, but one which really stymies me and for which I really don't have any satisfactory answer. The Rav, as you know, operated with various personality types. Much of the writing of the Rav revolves around typologies of personalities. Ish halacha, ish hadat, ish hada'at, man of faith, Adam 1, man of majesty, Adam 2, man of covenant. In the Hesped of Rav Elvel, you have Ish Rosh Hashanah and Ish Yom Kippur. In the Hesped of Reb Zelv Gold, you have Ish Kedushas Shabbos V'Yomtiv and Ish Kedushas Rosh Chodesh. In the Hesped of Reb Chaim Eizer, you have Ish Tzitz and Ish Choshen. He's working consistently with typologies. But yet, the irony for me is that nowhere does the Rav present a typology that describes what he himself was, that describes a typology of somebody who's a giant of Torah and a giant of philosophy. The Rav was an ish halacha, of course, but that typology, as defined in the essay that bears the name ish halacha, does not do justice to the multiple complexity of interests that was the Rav. And so we have this irony that an ish halacha, the type, could not have written ish halacha, the book. The way the Rav describes an ish halacha in ish halacha is impossible for that person to have written the book called ish halacha. And so the Rav, with all of the typologies, leaves us in the dark because he never develops a typology of himself. That typology isn't in his writings. Weiter. The Rav was a master of self-description. Actually, the Rav was very complex in this area as well. He balanced tremendous privacy. Tremendous privacy. He writes about his relationship with his father. He writes that the most holy and precious thing is the Kodesh Kodashim. And nobody can go into the Kodesh Kodashim. It's so private. Nobody is allowed in. So the holiest things, the most precious things, are personal and private. But yet at the same time, he was very easily self-revelatory. He describes as a young child listening to his father trying to resolve a steer in the Rambam, and the Rambam is sitting next to him on the bed. He describes what he felt like when he was learning, surrounded by the Tanoim and the Amoraim and Rashi and the Balei HaTosfos. He describes the pain that he felt when his wife was dying in the hospital. He describes the loneliness he felt for his wife after she died. He described so much about himself, but he never described what it was like to be himself. He never described what he was, what it's like to be a first-rate Talmud Chacham and a first-rate philosopher, and even more important, why it's important to be a first-rate Talmud Chacham and a first-rate philosopher. The man who disclosed so much about his inner life never disclosed anything about what made him so unique, both among Talmidei Chachamim and among philosophers. He never wrote a programmatic essay on the role of general studies in Torah education. And so it remains for us, who are interested in this subject, to do some detective work. We have to try to figure out, based on the writings that we have, what was the Rav's position. We at the Rabbi Soloveitchik Institute are now in the process of transcribing many, many tapes of the Rav. We have access to some 3,000 or 4,000 tapes of the Rav that aren't out there. And as we go along, we keep on finding really interesting nuggets. And our goal is that as the time progresses, we've only done about 100, 120 or so, that we will find a lot more that will be able to flesh out this subject in much greater detail. For the time being, I just want to bring to your attention briefly just a couple of sources, and then I think I'm already over my time and will come to a quick conclusion. On page 6, there's a talk that the Rav gave to the parents of the Maimonides School, where the Rav talks about, and I'm only going to be able to summarize it, that we believe that a Jewish child can carry a double load, that it's possible for somebody to be engaged as a student in a school, in a day school, to be engaged in both secular and specific Judaic studies. A child can master both scientific and biblical Talmudic knowledge, and they're not mutually exclusive. You'll take a look, you'll read it, and you'll analyze it on your own. In an essay published recently in Ha'adam Va'olamo on page 7, the Rav talks about this image of Ramatayim Tzofim. He talks about the two peaks, and he bases it on a Maimer Chazal about Elkanah. And he talks about in the middle of the paragraph, the first major paragraph on the top of page 7, Anu Yehudim Oskim Miyamav Shel Elkanah Bebiniyat HaGesher Hazeh, the gesher between the two peaks. Lo gamano adayin et hamalacha azu v'anu yodim ki lo alacha ligmor. Kashe u'memushechet hi melechet hagishur. V'harei hi hamatara shela anu makdishim et kol ma'amatzeinu. I need to just make it very clear that the Rav did not write these words. And we have to be very careful, not to read into and be medayik in the words of somebody summarizing the Rav as much as we need to, the flip side, be medayik and analyze very carefully things that the Rav wrote himself. We don't have time to do it this evening, but on the left side, I Xeroxed an English version of the very same talk that he gave, and you see that they're very different. So you have to be very, very careful when it comes to eliciting particular positions of the Rav, bedafka from articles that were summaries of things that he said or said in his name. But you get the basic gist, and that's really all I want to get from here is the gist. Ein anu rotzim lehitztamtzem berama achat, she'ifatenu hi sheyitave izun v'chibur nachon bein olam hakodesh hayahuduti u'bein olam hamada v'hadad shel klal ha'enoshut. And he keeps on going. I Xeroxed the passage here from Lonely Man of Faith. I Xeroxed the passage from Confrontation, where the Rav talks about the importance of being engaged with the world. If we had the time, we would analyze the difference between the Rav's understanding of science and technology in the world of Mada and the Rav's understanding of philosophy in the world of Mada. It's easier to come up with an interpretation of the Rav's attitude to science and technology in a very positive sense than it is to come up with an interpretation of the Rav's attitude to philosophy, although my best read of this is exactly the passage that Rabbi Sachs quoted from Dr. Tversky's Hesped. And so I want to conclude. And this conclusion is based on something that I both read and heard from Professor David Schatz. The Rav wrote in Majesty and Humility about a Rashi at the beginning of Bereshis. And he wrote how Rashi quotes a Medrash that a human being was created in two different ways. One shot, Rashi says, is that Hashem gathered his earth, gathered his dust, me'al baruchot. And the other is, davar acher, natal afaro mimakom she'ne'amar bo mizbach adama ta'aseli. So you have a double image. One is that the earth which created human beings came from all over the place. And the other is that it came from one specific spot. And I want to conclude by reading a little keta here from the Rav. Man was created of cosmic dust. Because this the Rav published in his lifetime. God gathered the dust of which man was fashioned from all parts of the earth. Indeed, from all the uncharted lanes of creation. Man belongs everywhere. Man is cosmic through his intellectual involvement, his intellectual curiosity of cosmic universal dimensions. He wants to know not only about the things that are close to him, but about things that are far removed from him, millions of light years away. Man asks himself, to whom does the universe belong? And the answer is, L'Hashem Haaretz U'Mlo'ah. But to whom did God entrust this earth and its fullness? To man who studies and comprehends the cosmic drama, who makes an effort to understand them. Man owns the world through his intellectual involvement. Man is questing, an explorer, an adventurer. The other interpretation, davar acher, man was created from the dust of a single spot. Man is not cosmic, he is here-minded. He may travel and travel, but yet the traveler, the adventurer out to conquer infinity, will surely return home. The dust of which man was fashioned was not taken from all parts of the universe, but from a single spot on a mountain where an altar was many, many years later constructed. As we said before, each man is created from and attached to a single spot, the origin from which he cannot escape. The home for which man yearns attracts him like a powerful magnet. It brings him back no matter how far he has traveled. And he quotes from Robert Louis Stevenson, home is the sailor, home from the sea, and the hunter, home from the hill. These beautiful lines by Robert Louis Stevenson contains more than a nostalgic note. And so my conclusion is that even though the Rav did not present this in an autobiographical context, maybe as we try to summarize, maybe this can be seen precisely in that way. The Rav studied and comprehended. The Rav was an explorer and an adventurer. The Rav traveled the highways and byways of Kant and Cohen and Hegel and Kierkegaard and Otto and Nietzsche and Bergson and Aristotle and Galileo and Newton. But in the end, the Rav returned to the home for which man yearns, which attracts him like a powerful magnet. It brings him back no matter how far he has traveled. Home is the sailor home from the sea and the hunter home from the field. And home for the Rav was Beis Brisk. Home for the Rav was a Blat Gemara. Home for the Rav was a Rambam, his beloved Rambam, and the basic fundamentals of the Masorah as he understood them to be and as he fought so tenaciously to insist remain as part of the Neches of Klal Yisrael. Rav Yosef Dov, Ben HaRav Moshe HaLevi, Tehei Nishmoso, Tzuro B'Tzuror HaChai.
Rabbi Schechter's final sentence, of course, reminds me that this year we mark the 10th Yahrzeit of the Rav, this Pesach, but also his 100th birthday. Two events of note, which are being marked in various ways, both here and in the United States, and of course headed by the work of the Soloveitchik Institute. Okay, to consider what all of this means for what we do tomorrow morning in the classroom, I turn to my good friend, Dr. Bivoli Gribitz.
hope this doesn't mean that I have to speak about Kant tomorrow morning in the classroom, because I'm not prepared. First of all, I want to say it's a privilege once again to hear Rabbi Schachter. We had many opportunities when we were living in Manhattan to hear him on a Shabbat morning and a Shabbat afternoon. I remember now how much we missed that experience, but we all left Manhattan. So, I'll reflect a little bit. When Rabbi Sachs asked me to come, it's always because he wants me to reflect from the field. And I'm going to take a reflection way back from my own childhood. And I'll tell you how it just came up again in the context of what I do here in Israel. The first time I was at the Kotel was in 1969. And I had been in Israel before, but before you could go to the Kotel. And we came as a group of teenagers, as many people who are sitting here in this room came, first with a group of their own friends from high school. And we arrived at the Kotel on the same day and at the same moment when the first American, whose name I now forget, was reaching the moon in the summer of 1969. Neil Armstrong. And I remember then having been a very recent 1 month graduate of the double curriculum and having mastered the dual curriculum and been able to concentrate, I hope I did that in high school, on science and on general studies and on Torah, what it was in those days. I remember, though, very seriously reflecting on the magnitude of Jewish history that I saw then in the Kotel, the 2,000 years of everything coming together that I had been studying, and also the brand new attempt at reaching space. I was also a child of the space age, the race of America against the Soviet Union. And I remember feeling overwhelmed. We had our radios on our ears, and we were there davening at the Kotel. And I remember feeling overwhelmed by that experience. Just a few weeks ago, this year, the Pikuach of the Mamachti Dati in Yerushalayim decided to give a Hishtalmud for principals to help us develop our Ruchani side. And I have to say, I've spoken at Atid about this before. You have different stages in your life when you're more Ruchani and less Ruchani. I admit that I think at this stage in my life, my students who are in high school, or junior high and high school, are a little bit more Ruchani than I am. And I appreciate the opportunity this year, every 2 weeks, we discuss some of the principles together, how to develop Ruchnius in ourselves and in our students. And on the first day of the Hishtalmud, they asked the mentor, the manche, asked each of us to describe, to try to remember a spiritual experience from the time when we were in high school. And it was this experience that popped into my mind. And I spoke about it to the other principals. Other principals had different kinds of things to say. Anyway, in the context of thinking about this lecture, of course, one cannot resist mentioning the excitement of this week, and I have to admit it, and I don't know if the students that I teach feel it the way I do, but seeing Ilan Ramon take off, being part of now my Zionism and having now become a citizen of Israel, and watching him take off on television as the first Israeli in space, I mean, it sounds kitschy, I don't know, but and then to see that Kiddush cup floating through was really something for me. And in thinking about this evening and the confluence of general studies and Jewish studies and how it prepares us to live in this world, and thinking of my own odyssey from a Jewish and general studies child to somebody who's supposed to be pushing it on the next generation of children, I had to connect those two experiences. So if they're relevant or not relevant, you'll all decide. Now, some musings on if we accept, and I certainly do, the position that is the Rav's position that general studies is important, milachatchila, and also important for our understanding of Torah. How can we do this in the classroom, in the schools, and how can we do this especially in this generation which I think is different from the way a lot of us grew up. Things are changing all the time. I think that the issues that children deal with these days are different, at least from the ones that I dealt with when I was a child, and I'll say a few things about this. First of all, let me just state at the outset that when I speak from both of my experiences, one in Jewish education in the United States and now in education, we don't say Jewish education, in Israel, there is a little bit of difference when we discuss this topic, because the compartmentalization that we had to deal with in the Jewish day school in America isn't always as apparent as and as difficult here. One of the advantages I feel now in curriculum planning here in Israel is that when we talk about Sifrut, we're talking about literature. There's Jewish literature and general literature, and it can be taught by the same teacher. I don't have to hire two people the way I did in the United States, one to teach Hebrew and Jewish literature and another to teach general literature, although sometimes in America I thought it would have been nice if we could have found more people who could have taught both of those, and that's an issue. Here, I never have to talk to parents about the dual curriculum, about two curricula. Nobody ever says to me here, why don't you cut down a little bit on the Jewish studies? And I heard that in the United States, even in an Orthodox day school. And on the other hand, at least in the context in which I work, nobody ever says, why don't you cut down a little bit on the general studies? In other words, there's more of a confluence in the heads of the parents and the children that we're teaching here about one curriculum and not two curricula. There are not two sets of teachers here in America, and one of the people know here one of my critiques of the Jewish day school in America, and I know there are some schools that are trying to overcome this these days, was the idea of two heads, a head of Jewish studies and a head of general studies. If there's a head of Jewish studies and a head of general studies and a Jewish studies staff and a general studies staff, then you're always going to have two heads. Now, I'm not talking about integration of Jewish and general studies. I'm just talking about if you're trying to get a student to live, to swim in both worlds, then you have to have role models who swim in both worlds, and you also have to have a structure that shows that both worlds come together. Right, in the school that I run in Israel, we have much more of that, and I am constantly looking for and once in a while finding the teacher who can teach, and I have a teacher who teaches Tanakh and physics. Right, I want the girls to see that the same human being can teach Tanakh and physics. I want the girls to see that the science and math teachers, even though those who don't specifically teach Tanakh, do come into a shiur, do come in when the Rav talks, do come in when I say a Dvar Torah, you know, participate in all of the activities. But this is a very big issue. Let me say a few words about teachers. To push any kind of philosophy of curriculum, and Rabbi Schachter spoke a little bit about this at the dinner earlier, one has to have teachers who are, let's not even talk about trained to do this, but first of all committed to this kind of largeness of knowledge. One of our problems, and I don't have to go into it, especially here in Israel, is that teaching is a low-level profession. It is not a distinguished profession. People don't want to be teachers. It's all known. I do a lot of work with young people, and over the years, if I've been talking to young people about going into education for more than 20 years now, every year I see fewer and fewer. And that's not because I'm far away. It's just because they're not there. It's a problem. We have to deal with it somehow. And especially when we find people, and there are people who are, there are young people who are very well educated, who are very curious, who have gone to yeshivas and who go to the university, how to convince them, maybe Rabbi Adler will talk about this, how to convince them to want to go into teaching is a very big issue for the translation of Rav Soloveitchik's views and Rabbi Schachter's views into the practical. Now, I don't think I have to go into for this evening, although maybe there are questions on it. We can talk about the scheduling issues In the United States, you have the two philosophies of scheduling, right? One is there should be Jewish studies in the morning when your heads are clear, and general studies in the afternoon. That's really based on the old idea of when my father went to yeshiva, that they brought the general studies teachers over from the public schools to teach after 3 o'clock, and that was the way they got the great general studies teachers. That's still being done in many places. There are others, and I'm a product of the tradition that's for the mixed day, that you, to show that you live in both worlds, you move from Tanakh to math to Talmud to science to history and back again. In this country, if you want to get money from Misrad HaDatot, you have to have Jewish studies first thing in the morning. I will not comment on, after you do that, whether a girls' school can really get the money from Misrad HaDatot. That's for a different group, but that's a requirement. And all of these issues, which somehow seem, and very often in schools, are given to the administrator, like the administrator with a small a, or the minhalan, who is not necessarily somebody who came up from the world of education. When these issues are given to that person to work out, then the issues will not reflect the vision of some total view of Jewish and general studies. And that's a mistake that's often made. Financing, of course, is a problem. When you want to talk about giving over some kind of values and role modeling, and you're dealing with 40 children in a class, I find it impossible. In my school, we don't have 40 children in a class, even though the Misrad HaChinuch requires it, because I can't understand how one could teach. I can understand how one can give a lecture to 40 or 80, and now I can stand up in front of the 400 girls and say it's Dvar Torah, but that's not really teaching, getting to every single one. The best class I ever taught had 18 students in it. That was one time only. I don't know if I'll ever get that again. In any case, let me say just a few words about what seems to be bothering the generation that I work with now. And I'm talking about religious kids who come from religious homes and who basically know what they're in a religious school for. They have a lot of issues of emunah because of their age, also because of what's going on today in Israel. There's a crisis of faith that has to do with the crisis of the Medina and who is the enemy and how we are being battered, especially here in Yerushalayim. The kids want to hear about emunah all the time, but when you bring them somebody to talk about emunah, they get bored right away because it's not really a topic that anybody knows how to deal with, not on the 7th grade level or on the 11th grade level. You have kids who are basically religious people, who are Shomrei Shabbat, who are Shomrei Kashrut, but who get to 11th grade and then they find a crisis in davening. And you have kids who in 7th grade, they say, I want to daven, I don't want to daven. They daven a little better, they daven a little worse, but they're all going through the motions. But when they get to 11th grade, they can't do it. I had a student, I cried for the first time in my school. I mean, I cry all the time about the Misrad HaChinuch and Manchi, but I mean, real crying about it. When a 11th grader, one of the girls in the first grade that I started at Evelina with, dropped out of the school. And I mean, she left the school. She transferred to a Chiloni school. We have had other girls who, after 8th grade, have realized that they don't really belong in a religious environment and who have left. But this is a girl who, in my opinion, belongs in our school and decided, without discussing with me, that she was transferring to a Chiloni school. I heard some rumors about it from various kids. And then she came to see me. And it was already done. I mean, there was nothing that I could do to change her mind. And I said, why are you doing this? And she said, because I'm in crisis. I've felt myself becoming less interested in Jewish studies and more interested in general studies. So I said, so what? You can go through a stage being less interested in Jewish studies, more interested in general studies. We have good general studies teachers here. I even said to her something that I never say. If you want to do only 3 points Toshba instead of 5 points Toshba, I will let you do it. But she said, I find myself thinking thoughts about not being Shomeret Mitzvot. And I said to her, so what? There is still room for you in my heart. You can still stay here. We can work this out. And she said to me, Hamanahelet, I can't do this to you. And then I thought, what had I done? Like, that, this was the over role modeling. And I realized, and then her mother told me, that she felt she was so attached to me over the years, and me as a role model, and this was one of the Sephardi girls from the Shchunot, where the role modeling was not muvan me'elav, that she and I would connect, that she felt that she, when she went into religious crisis, she couldn't disappoint me. And therefore, she had to leave the school. I saw this as a tremendous failure, even though 10 teachers came to tell me this was brewing before and it has nothing to do with you. And I am actually hoping, and I'm staying in contact with her, that in a month or so she will realize and come back. I had experiences like that in Ramaz where kids left for whatever reason and then they came back. But when you talk about role modeling and wanting to connect to a child, what happens when you overconnect and then they break and see it in terms of you? That's a big issue, I think, for religious educators. And I started talking about this because I wanted to say about the kids who want to be religious and don't know how to do it when they feel that they're cracking a little bit. And we know with our experience that many of them come back. But getting them through that stage, while we also want them to study science and math, is very, very complicated. Now, because that brings me to the last point that Rabbi Schachter made, which is that our real goal is to have them swimming in general studies while they feel at home in the Masorah. Now, first of all, how are they going to feel at home in the Masorah? Only if they come from homes that are at home in the Masorah. The school isn't the major agent here, even if we have them many, many hours a day. That's why we have to do more and more work with parents. That's why we have to convince parents to see the vision that we see or remind them why they came to the school. And we have to take risks in helping them change even their own homes. When we talk about the Rav and his multiple complexity of interests, it seems to me that the only way we can really generate this in children is by surrounding children with people who have this kind of curiosity, but who speak to them begova einayim, not from above, but together with them. How can we ever get such people to hang around high schools? I'm not even saying to teach in high schools. I'd like to be in a position, maybe soon we will be in a position, where we can get people just to hang around in high schools. I think that the schools, and there are some schools, who are able to develop batei midrash for older students in the school and bring the older students. I know in Chorev they do this. They have older students who sit in the Beit Midrash, and they work with the younger students. That kind of role modeling, if they're the right role models, is very, very important. It's hard to say how students will turn out, and that's why I never like to, everybody, when you recruit for the school, they always say, oh, what is your ideal graduate? You can never really say what your ideal graduate is, because if you're a good PR person, you want to build your graduates into your ideal graduates. Like, however they end up will be our ideal graduate. But I think we have a lot of challenges here. I do not think that we're going to grow up a lot of students to become the Rav. But I wonder what more we can be doing in creating school climate, teachers, role model, and some kind of total experience that will at least make students want to have that kind of curiosity and do it in a way that's religious and full of Torah, so that they always come back to that as their base.
Harav Shimon Adler, Rosh Minhal Chinuch Hadati b'Mishrad Chinuch.
אני חייב להתנצל שאני מדבר בעברית. ופשוט אני נאמן לכתוב שעליי לדבר בעברית, אם כי באנגלית היה לי קצת יותר קשה לעשות זאת. אחרי הדברים המרתקים של הרב שכטר, שבאומנות הצליח להכניס אותנו לתוך עולם מאוד אינטימי של אדם אחד מרתק, הרב סולובייצ'יק, וודאי כולם כאן מחוברים אליו, נדמה לי שהערב הזה מבטא יותר מכל געגועים אל הרב סולובייצ'יק, ואולי בראש ובראשונה משום שכפי שסיים הרב שכטר, הבית שלו נשאר לאורך כל חייו הרמב״ם או דף הגמרא, בשעה שחלקנו אולי מרגיש קרוע, בשונה ממנו עם כל השערות שאפיינו את האיש הזה, האיש הגדול הזה, הרב סולובייצ'יק, תמיד הבית נשאר בית יציב ומאוד מחובר. אני מבקש לעבור מהעולם המאוד מעניין, מרתק, אבל אישי, דווקא להשתקפות שלו בחברה שלמה, במדינה גדולה, שאני בכמה דקות אנסה לסרטט איך באותה קבוצה שנקראת היום החינוך הממלכתי דתי, כרבע מיליון תלמידים, מתבטאת הסערה הזו, המתח הזה, המשבר, כל המילים שאתה נקטת בהן, וכולנו חיים אותם, אני משער, ביום-יום שלנו. ראשית, צריך לציין, כשזה מדובר במדינת ישראל, בחברה הדתית, כפי שנהוג לקרוא לה, שהיא מרגישה כאן מיעוט. אמנם זו מדינת ישראל, אבל הציבור הקרוי דתי מרגיש כחוויה אולי מאוד משמעותית לחיים שלו מיעוט אידיאולוגי, ומטבעו של מיעוט שהוא נתון ללחץ בלתי פוסק של הסביבה בתוכה הוא חי. הרי מי שנולד אל תוך הרוב באופן טבעי מבין שהוא הולך בדרך הנורמלית. מי שנולד אל המיעוט צריך כל הזמן להסביר לעצמו מדוע אני כאן ולא עם כולם.
Tonight's discussion and to have an opportunity to share some of my thinking about the Rav with you, and particularly to have the opportunity to hear from my distinguished colleagues who took all of this
theory and
brought it in with all of its even perhaps greater degrees of complexity into the current educational situation. I also appreciate a lot of the comments that were made, and I have a lot of response comments to make, but I will save them. And I also appreciate the fact that the Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik Institute is a co-sponsor of tonight's program, precisely in honor of and in memory of an acknowledgement of the fact that we have a confluence of, this is the 10th Yahrzeit year of the Rav, and this coming February in Adar will be the Rav's 100th birthday. In conclusion, I would like the Rav to speak for himself. I want the Rav to conclude. I don't want myself to conclude. And I want to read to you from something that the Rav said at a rabbinic alumni convention. At a rabbinic alumni convention of Yeshiva University in 1956. I feel that the yeshiva has the finest Talmudic faculty in the world. Rabbinic literature is studied in full depth, and our goal is to educate first-class rabbinical scholars. Simultaneously, we wish to give these scholars secular academic ability. I have heard criticism against the yeshiva that we have not yet achieved the proper synthesis between Torah study and secular endeavor. I claim that the true greatness of the yeshiva is that it does not have this synthesis. The truth is that there is no real synthesis in the world. If there is a contradiction between Torah and secular endeavor, then synthesis is not possible. If there is a thesis and antithesis, then no synthesis is possible. Synthesis in general is very superficial. It is apologetic. It imitates others and the individual loses his uniqueness. In synthesis, no one succeeds. My students go from my shiur on the first floor of the yeshiva building to their college classes on the third floor. In my class, they study in depth such Talmudic topics as all kinds of sugyas here in Maseches Gittin, and then they go upstairs to their college classes where they study theories in mathematics and physics. I am proud when my student is both a Torah scholar and a good college student. If there were a synthesis, both achievements would be weakened. We have a yeshiva, and because the times demand it, we also have a university. These two divisions will not be synthesized. They will remain two institutions. It may be like a man with two heads, but it is better to have two heads than not to have one. Thank you very much for coming this evening.
Sure that you'll all be happy to hear that I've got a lot to say. You'll probably be even happier to hear that I'm not going to say it. What I'd like to do is thank the participants. First, Rabbi Adler, I think, has convinced us that a serious discussion about the state of the State of Israel is certainly in place. And this question of emunah versus Torah, the study, the traditional of study of Torah, is not a new question. And we live under the banner of the Nefesh HaChayim, who said that the Jews have made a mistake because they study Sifrei Musar V'Yirah. And they've got to get back to studying Gemara. And today, we see the young people are yelling, literally, for the Sifrei Musar V'Yirah, and can't understand anymore why they are studying Talmud all the time. So I thank you for making us aware of that problem. Dr. Gribitz, Beverly, I hear you speak more often. It's always a pleasure. You bring us into the world of reality that I've tried all my life to escape, but which I know is where the action really is. And I think someday we'll all be privileged to come to that big dinner that thanks you for leaving the world of American education and coming to Eretz Yisrael. Thank you. This is not the dinner. There'll be a dinner. You'll get a notification. It'll cost you money. I'd like to thank Rabbi Sachs, who organizes, arranges, and provides the spirit for Atid, which I think is doing a little bit of good. And a little bit of good is good. Mostly tonight I'd like to thank Rabbi Schechter, who's come to us, and I'd like to take issue with one thing that Rabbi Schechter has said twice since he's come to Israel. And that is that at two occasions he said, I am not an educator. And Rabbi Schechter, it seems to me that you may not be an educator, but you're a marvelous teacher. And we could probably sit and listen to you for hours and hours. So that saying that you are not an educator is probably not exactly the truth. I would be very happy if you would join our staff in the yeshiva and do whatever it is that you do when you're not being an educator. I'd like to say that one of the dilemmas that we have with Rabbi Soloveitchik, I was a student of Rabbi Soloveitchik for a number of years. Most of that time I was either in awe or in fear of Rabbi Soloveitchik. And even though I spent 1 year of those years reading in shiur every day, it did not in any way alleviate my fear. The reason that I read, by the way, was because my name starts with a B. And that year, I had the poor fortune of being the first B in Shir. And those of you who had been in the Shir know that Rabbi Soloveitchik on the first day of Shir got a list, alphabetical. Those days, alphabetical was not obvious. Somebody had to actually do it. You couldn't just knock it out of the computer. And there I was at the top of the list. I didn't know this, but Rabbi Soloveitchik's habit was that on the first day he would call the first person on the list to read. Then, after that day was over, he would leave the list on the table because Rabbi Soloveitchik traveled light. The other guys in the shir would steal the list, either burn it or eat it or in some way do away with it. And Rabbi Soloveitchik would come in the next day to give shir. He'd look for the list that wouldn't be there. And he would automatically call the same name that he called yesterday. So this was a life sentence. Until the next year when there was a new list and I could pray that somebody with an A would make it into the world of Torah. Rabbi Soloveitchik, it seems to me, dealt with typologies. When he dealt with typologies, what he meant is there was no one else like Rav Velvele, Rav Chaim Ozer, Rav Chaim Heller, his father. He lived in a world where there were people who were absolutely unique. And he understood that, just as his father understood that, about himself. For if we would see Rabbi Soloveitchik as a model for education, what that would mean is that first, every child should become the biggest Talmid Chacham in the world. And then every child should then go and study nuclear physics and become the greatest physicist in the world. This doesn't seem to me to be such a practical suggestion. I think that even though I come from a family, you know, my parents were kind of Holocaust survivors, they thought that degrees would beat it. You know, like you had a lot of degrees, everything would be all right. I grew up in that world. So you can get a lot of degrees, but that doesn't make you into Rabbi Soloveitchik. To stand astride those two mountains, to be able to see clearly what the Torah is and what the world has to say about itself, is a colossal endeavor that I don't imagine many people can follow. And therefore, our problem is not what Rabbi Soloveitchik was, but our problem is what about Rabbi Soloveitchik can be taken, absorbed, used, re-engineered for us, the common people, who want to follow in his great footsteps. The Rambam told us Avram Avinu was a great man. And then he told us that Moshe Rabbeinu was a great man. But he didn't tell us that because he thought that we, any of us, would be either Avram Avinu or Moshe Rabbeinu. But he did think that by studying those people and looking hard at their achievements, we would be able to move ourselves a couple of centimeters in the right direction. Ultimately, I think that's the hope of good Jewish education. Thank you.